Hi there, this is Yarrow, and welcome to Vested Capital, episode number 28, featuring my guest, David Cicirelli, the CEO and co-founder of Voices.com. Vested Capital is a podcast about how people make money and put their capital to work. I interview startup founders, angel investors, venture capitalists, crypto and stock traders, real estate investors, and leaders in technology. Today, my guest David is going to take us back in time and explain how he and his wife launched Voices.com, a marketplace that connects over 2 million providers of voice talent with customers who are looking to purchase some kind of voice content for things like commercials, maybe podcast audio like you're listening to now, possibly for a documentary voiceover, a character in a cartoon, anywhere you need voice. They provide the talent to do the job. As you can expect, as a marketplace, there was a serious challenge at the start with growing both the supply side and the demand side. I was majorly impressed to hear David share the story of how he was responsible for growing demand, which meant finding the customers. And he did over 10,000 phone calls just one by one, trying to convince these people to come over to voices.com and purchase talent there, you know, hire people to create audio content. Meanwhile, his wife was on the other side. She, in fact, was voice talent herself. That's how they met. So you'll hear the origin story of their meeting. And she was more in charge of the marketing side and growing the talent pool to basically have supply so you can provide the service. We also hear the story about voices.com, the domain name, which I was super curious about since it is a premium domain name. And it's a fun story about how David managed to acquire that back when they had almost no money. So very difficult to get a higher price domain name in that kind of situation. We move forward in the story and hear how David started changing the pricing model. That was an important step. They had to build some escrow technology to do that. We move forward again to hear more about the growth in terms of the team and eventually getting an office, all the way up to the current situation where they recently raised funding. Not that recently, actually. It was 2017 now, so it's a few years ago. That was their last raise. They did raise some debt financing in several different raises before that, but the $18 million US raise they did with Morgan Stanley as the lead was a major stepping stone towards listing on the NASDAQ exchange, which is an IPO that David is hoping and working towards in the short-term future. And of course, that money goes to everything you would think it goes to, you know, growing the team, marketing and sales. It's just getting everything professional, ready to go, including the board of directors, board advisors, everyone they need in place to do that IPO. And David is fantastic at telling a lot of longer answers to questions. It's not a short podcast, as you can tell. David has a wealth of information and experience from being the CEO from day one of a bootstrap startup to now a company that's starting to raise and get ready for the IPO phase, including like what's his hiring philosophy and some tips around that. Obviously, everything they did to grow the company during the early days, all the ins and outs of how he runs the company and how his role has changed, and even what he's done regarding his own finances. And, you know, has he taken money off the table since all of his net worth is basically tied up into voices.com? So it's a great interview for anyone interested in starting a marketplace and everything that goes on behind the scenes. And I know you'll get a lot out of it if that is you. Today's sponsor for this episode is InboxDone.com, a virtual executive assistant service that will provide you with two dedicated US-based virtual executive assistants who specialize in written communication, in particular, handing over your email to them. So delegating your email so you no longer are stuck in your inbox all day. They also do your calendar for you, so no more back and forth emailing or managing all the research and questions for whatever kind of calendar you have to manage, or maybe several calendars. They do data entry, admin tasks, social media replies, basically anything where you need a high quality attention to detail, written English kind of person. You're going to get two of them. Every client gets two assistants as part of the Inbox Done service. And that is a deliberate decision. It's so you have redundancy. If you've ever hired any kind of virtual assistant before, you know the challenge of dealing with that horrible situation where you hire someone, you train them for a month or two, and then they disappear. And if you, you know, go find someone else, you have to train them from the beginning. Very frustrating. With Inbox Done, because you get two managers who are long-term orientated, growth-focused. They're going to stick with you. And even if one of them does have to leave, you have the second one in place who retains the knowledge of how to support you, and they can train another second inbox assistant for you. So you don't have to worry about retraining from scratch every single time there's a turnover. Plus, you get the benefit of two people working with you. So, you know, double the attention, double the brain capacity, and two people who understand what you do and how to help you. And you can delegate to them as much as you like. So if you're currently drowning in any kind of admin tasks or email or anything that you feel like could be handed over to someone else in a virtual capacity, inboxdone.com is the place to go. If you've got the money for like a part-time assistant, it's a good fit for you. Head to that website, book a discovery call, tell us what you need help with, and then we can provide you with two dedicated virtual executive assistants. That's inboxdone.com. Okay, that's it for me. Now we're going to begin the interview with David Cicirelli. Hi, David. Thank you so much for joining me today.
I appreciate the time to chat, and I think we're in for a good one today.
Yeah, so most people will know now you are the co-founder and CEO of Voices.com, and I was digging into your platform as well as your own personal history, the company's history. You've been at it for a while, which is fantastic. It's nice to hear a longevity story. We're going to dive into all of that. Maybe just for the people who don't really know what Voices.com is, what is it today? And even what was the original plan for it when you first started?
Sure. Well, we'll start with the present. Voices is really an online marketplace, an online freelance marketplace where we're connecting creative talent. Let's call them audio producers, voice talent, translators, and musicians with those corporate clients, often at advertising agencies, creative director at a marketing department. And the common theme there is that these clients have an important story to tell, a message to share, to educate, inform, or otherwise entertain their audience. And they're looking to predominantly find a voice to help tell that story. So we serve as that marketplace, as there have sprung up a number of freelance marketplaces nowadays that kind of bring these two parties together. That's what we are today.
This is a funny thought I had. I don't know if this is relevant, but I was looking at your service, and I know a lot of it's also about bespoke voice talent. It's like, I need a custom script read out by a great voice. And it could be something simple like my podcast. I might want to get an intro done that I would then use over and over again for the show. But I've noticed a lot recently, I'm throwing a bit of a left-wing question here, it's all over the place, but YouTube videos, you're hearing a lot of automated robotic voices. Like people, I think, are literally just uploading a text script and having a robot read out, and then they're putting that over some images and releasing a video. I'm asking this, I guess, because this feels very current too, with AI coming into play with voices. Have you found people come to you to do a voiceover for a full YouTube video? And what is your thoughts around the AI side of things?
Yeah, so internet, we just kind of classify it as internet videos. It could be used, you know, as mostly for YouTube, of course, but other social platforms. That is the number one most used and fastest growing category. It's 65% of all of the jobs on voices.com are in internet videos. And that category grew at 220% last year. So it's by far and away, you know, almost like that primary use case, if you will, that we go to market with. With respect to AI voices, I think it's a really good observation. I mean, this in effect was the existential threat that our investors now, you know, asked us at the time of due diligence was, what is going to be the one thing that may put you out of business or put this our investment at risk? And I always had said the well-funded competitor. That was just always something I was concerned about. But I think what has transpired over the last 5 years has been the increased usage and sophistication of AI voices or synthetic voices. People kind of use those terms interchangeably. There is certainly a time and a place for their use. I almost think of it like a 2x2 matrix where you have kind of time along the horizontal. And the shorter the recording or the shorter like the utterance that you'd be hearing back, okay, fine, you might be able to bear with a robotic voice. Whereas the more kind of, and on the vertical axis, you know, could either be kind of quality or like kind of character, the amount of character work that needs to be done. And if it's really just an industrial purpose, think of like a parking garage or like a kiosk or, you know, trains, planes, and automobiles type travel information that's changing all the time. You don't need a character to do that. It just needs to be voice for informational purposes only. But as you get more into character-driven content that is also long form in terms of it being narrative, not just kind of raw data that's being read out audibly, that's where I think you would be moving away, and really synthetic voice or an AI voice would not be suitable for characters and where there's a narrative to be told. So there's a time and a place. We actually see some, you know, call them big tech companies or even startups that are looking to create their own synthetic voice, and they need data to do so. And the data here would actually be voice data to train those systems. And so they actually be hiring, and sometimes using voices.com, as ironic as this sounds, using voices.com to hire live human voice actors at the tune of like hundreds of people at a time to actually create one of these synthetic voices. But I think in the long run, I mean, you're still going to have always the need for a person to breathe life into that script, just like you have on-camera actors and you still have animated characters. You know, animation isn't going to replace on-camera actors. I think they're two different use cases, time and a place where it makes sense to use those. So hopefully we can live in harmony with the robot voices.
Yeah, and I suspect you must be planning maybe in the future to provide the AI voice service with voices, as like it's not necessarily something that will make you go out of business. It'll become part of your business, I could imagine too.
We've thought of it. We've partnered with a few companies over the years. If you're in an ad agency, you want to hire a voice actor. If you're at a media and entertainment company. So we've not found nearly the amount of kind of like uptake with that. I think it comes down to knowing what we do best, which is we're the marketplace. We are not the tech enabler and provider of that type of technology. We're the marketplace. And therefore, that's kind of it's the business model we know really well. We're not a software as a service business where we're licensing out some kind of synthetic voice or kind of creating them on our own. You know, it's interesting we're even going in this direction because it has been a concern of a lot of talent believing that we're like ingesting all of this data and that behind the scenes, we've got this like big data sciences team creating this, you know, ominous synthetic voice that can do all manner of productions. It's just not true. The analogy I often give is kind of, I think, how some of the traditional broadcasters were so loath to embrace the internet at the beginning because they realize that they were trading kind of like, you know, analog dollars for digital dimes. And it's almost the same way. Like, we're enabling people to hire live human voice actors who really bring their unique ability to that recording and a great quality that the discerning ear can tell the difference. Certainly over 10 seconds, you definitely know it's a robot or not. Why would we trade that for we've even spoken to like PhDs and at MIT was one of the programs we were working with, just in terms of like an understanding like this technology. And some of the smartest minds in the world are like, this is 10 years away. And the key tipping point, if you will be the moment that a robotic voice is indistinguishable from a human. And that's kind of it's pretty far away where you're listening for any length of time. Sometimes in like the first 5 or 10 seconds, you're like, oh, can you tell the difference between the human and the robot? I'm like, yeah, I listened for 3 seconds. I barely kind of computed in my mind like what I was even hearing. But when you get into like 10, 15, 30 seconds, there's a certain lifelessness about it where I think if you're in the creative industries, you're not going to launch a product. You're not going to go out to the world with anything less than all the emotion that only a person can provide.
I feel like I've asked you my last question, the first question here, David, the future of your industry, which usually I would end this interview on, but I really appreciate your answer. And I've found myself having conversations like this recently, especially around film, like you were mentioning before with actors in movies, how there may be a time when, yes, small roles will be replaced by a digital human being acting, but the unique talent, especially for those main roles, will always require the human being for the dynamic nature. You can't kind of replicate that creativity in AI. So I feel like you're kind of giving that answer as well. There might be use cases for it, but for a lot of situations, that people always want a human being. So I appreciate that. And I know I asked you before we hit the record button for a claim to fame to sort of point out how big voices.com is today. So maybe we can work our way back. How big is voices.com today in terms of whatever numbers you want to share?
Sure. So in terms of the number of people that have taken that step to register free on the website, create a profile, you know, this is those creative talent. There's well over 2 million creative talent on the marketplace who mostly are voice talent because that's been our heritage for the better part of 15 years. But just this last summer, we actually expanded the platform to enable and welcome on other creative services that I would consider immediate adjacencies. So there's well over 50,000 translators, 30,000 audio producers and editors, somewhere between 25,000-30,000 musicians and kind of music composers and different musicians. So most marketplaces, in my experience, an observation of learning the best in class from others is you need to start with some semblance of supply, if you will. And in this case, it would be that kind of creative talent. And so getting into the realm of tens of thousands of talent in these new areas is really promising to us. Now it's all about driving that demand. And for what it's worth, we do that. It almost becomes our entire exclusive operation is on the demand side of the marketplace, those clients. And, we have a team of 130 plus people who are in, roles of sales and marketing, product development, technology, finance and operational roles as well too. So that's where we're at today.
And I noticed for those watching the video, I feel like it's a real background we're seeing behind you there. So are you in the voices.com office in London, Ontario, right? Are you back to work, like people with you there now? Or?
Well, we definitely were one of the first in the city to go wholesale remote at the onset of the pandemic. We're also one of the first to stop playing the guessing game when the COVID wave would subside. And so early on, we just said, look, it's going to be a hybrid work environment indefinitely and just embrace that. And then we also went to lengths to, the office is 45,000 square feet, which is a typical office, downtown office tower is about 15,000 square feet of floor. This is just having an incredibly, it's one floor plate, but very large. So we have lots of space to do all the necessary protocols, have the social distancing, for those that want to feel like they have more space, people can, all kinds of hot desks that they can certainly utilize as well too. So usually a couple, I'm in here pretty much every day. And I would say, call it 10 to 20% of the company kind of rotates in and out. It's not prescriptive. We're not demanding that people come in, but I think there's certainly a draw. If there's a team event or a quarterly kickoff or maybe annual strategic planning sessions, there's absolutely something to be said about bringing people together so long as they feel safe and comfortable in the environment that we've created and kind of, policies and practices to support that. I've actually certainly been noticing more people want to come in. And the reaction is afterwards like, wow, we should really do this again sometimes. I'm like, yeah, this used to happen every day. Maybe it'll take some time. I think we'll get back there eventually.
Okay, well, my show, I go back in time, so I'd love to hear the origin story of Voices. But just one question before that. What did you, David, do before you became the CEO and co-founder? I was saying to you this before we hit the record. I was like, I normally go by LinkedIn as a way to guide my early years for my guests. And I don't see, unless you're hiding some kind of jobs that, aren't relevant to your LinkedIn profile anymore. Were you born and raised in London, Ontario?
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot. I graduated from high school. One of the things mom and dad said before picking a career path and an educational path was go do some good in the world, go do some social work, go find a cause that you believe in. And the deal was with myself, my brother, and my sister was mom and dad would pay for an open-ended plane ticket anywhere in the world. And you had to go spend a year there in some type of program. So I found a group called Youth with a Mission, which is like a Christian missionary organization. I went to Perth, Western Australia, which was, I literally got out the globe. I grew up in Thunder Bay, Ontario, which is at the northern end of Lake Superior. And I found the furthest place away from home, according to the globe. So Perth, Western Australia is on the opposite end. And I had an open-ended plane ticket. There was certainly about 10 months of official programming with that group. And we helped find billets and kind of living quarters, if you will, for athletes competing in the 2000 Sydney Olympic Games. So kind of going back between Perth and Sydney, that was certainly my first away from home experience and a big learning one as well. When I came back, in fact, while I was there, I applied. But when I came back, I ended up actually going to an audio engineering school here in London, Ontario. So I was always really fascinated with sound. I played piano, played drums, helped outdo the sound booth at church and youth group and that kind of thing. And just, tinkered with it to the degree that I you know, knew enough to be dangerous and really enjoyed it. It was kind of the convergence between music and art and technology is what I really loved. And so that was the program. It was an audio engineering program where I went to school.
Okay. When you did that program, was your plan, like, was there a career path you saw that would kick off in your head at the time?
I think so. I think I wanted to do one, you know, I really wanted to open up my own recording studio. But, you know, through the year, there was all kinds of other opportunities presented, like being this, basically being the sound guy on like a cruise ship, which sounded really cool. You know, you only had to work in the evenings and tour the world. And some people absolutely went to do that. I was pretty set on opening my own recording studio. I wrote a business plan. My dad kind of serving as a mentor for those early years. He co-signed a loan. So he believed in my business plan, which included a list of audio recording equipment that I wanted to purchase. And it was about $15,000 of recording equipment. And that was, you know, precisely what I did. It was this small kind of project recording studio. I was going to record garage bands and hip hop bands and, you know, rock groups. And I actually got my name in the local newspaper, the London Free Press, on my birthday of all days. And that's really, I think, where the, you know, the origin story for Voices commences, because I met through that newspaper article, Stephanie, who's now, of course, my dear wife and co-founder in Voices. So it was really co-founder as a husband and wife team. And Stephanie, she would sing at weddings and funerals and special events. And her mom would carpool her around to go to all these in-person auditions and said, you know, you really ought to record your singing repertoire and get, you know, some CDs or, you know, an MP3 file that you could share with people so they could hear you sing instead of you having to do these in-person auditions. So Stephanie's mom actually cut out that newspaper article and left it for her on her bed and prompted her to come down to the studio. We ended up hitting it off, but because of that same article, there were other local businesses that wanted, you know, they wanted some work done. They would the phone system recording, some local commercials. They wanted a female voice. And I was a total nerd. I knew nobody else in the city, except I had just met Stephanie the other day. I said, so I gave her a call. I said, you've got a great singing voice. Have you ever done acting or performing? I've got a couple gigs that came in. What about this? And so this was my pitch to her, not my marriage proposal, but my pitch was, I'll be the recording engineer and you be the female voice talent. And here are the pages of copy. We'll just split the money 50-50. And that's how we ended up started working together. I think we were dating at the time. Of course, you know, fast forward, got married and have four kids, still both highly involved in the business. But that's how we got into the voiceover space. Maybe just to, if I may, kind of just the next natural step was, well, let's put up a website. You know, this is great. You can record a page of copy, get paid a couple $100. Way better than the exchange of time for money, which was selling hours out of the recording studio for $30 an hour. This was way faster path to, you know, financial success, if you will. So we put together this website, which I took out from the local public library, Web Design for Dummies. I got a copy of Dreamweaver, I think from LimeWire, some file sharing site, and just edited and created our own very primitive version of a website. It was a pretty static version of a website that showcased Stephanie as one voice talent and soon other voice talent from around the world. There's a fellow in Quebec who spoke French and he wanted to be listed. There are people who did character voices in Los Angeles, somebody in New York. And they said, hey, can I list my name and you link up my audio, my voice demo on your website? And we always just said yes. And at the same time, concurrently, we would get clients who would say, I found your website. I see this guy. How do I get in touch with him? And that was the proverbial aha moment, I call it, of like, wow, we're bringing these two parties together. Clearly, there's like supply and demand. I was really fascinated with the eBay business model at the time. It's where I bought and sold a lot of recording equipment. So I kind of understood the mechanics of how this worked. But I'm like, why don't we get out of the recording business and instead build out this from a website to a marketplace? That's precisely what we did. You know, we hired a web developer and it's been in a lot of ways, the same business that we started 15 years ago.
Okay. A few questions you've raised here. First one, voices.com. Great domain name. Was that what you purchased back then? And can we timestamp this? You're talking about LimeWire. So I'm thinking early 2000s. Was that when all that was happening?
Yeah. So 2004 was when we first launched our static version of the site. We rolled with launched as interactivevoices.com. So it's a little bit of a mouthful. I'm out of breath even saying it right now, which was actually the case. That was kind of part of the problem, was people didn't know if it was singular or plural, if it was only new and interactive media. What about all these other genres or categories of voice work? And so pretty pressed to change the domain name. This is kind of the height of, like, if you recall, like this Web 2.0 movement where everything was big and bright and bubbly. Companies were dropping their vowels from their name, and it was like Flickr and Twitter. And it was this whole kind of theme. And so I was like, oh, well, we should become, let's rebrand and let's become like Voxio or Voxy or something along these lines. And I actually put in a bid. There was an auction for Vox.com, which is Latin for voice. And I put in a bid of $100,000, which I did not have at the time. And we also lost the auction nonetheless. So no harm, no foul there. But I realized, okay, well, none of these other names are working. What if we could just get rid of the interactive part and just be voices.com? Just nice and clean, says what we are. The brand doubles as the address and destination. And I did what probably most of you have done. You just type it into Google and see what's there. And it ended up being a medical journal called Silencing the Critical Voices in Your Head. And it was from 1998. It predated Google's registration itself. It's like, it looked like it had been there forever, but it really wasn't being used. It hadn't been used since the year 2000. So I realized, though, I did a Whois lookup. I figured out who was owning the domain, but I realized if I, David at interactivevoices.com, with a real company and a website, we had 10,000 users on there at the time. Microsoft was a customer and NBC was a customer. They'd probably kind of put one and one together and jack up the price. So I actually had just met a business lawyer who moved into the co-working facility across the hall from us at the university. And I said, what kind of law do you practice? Corporate law? Great. Do you want to be our lawyer? Because I got a deal that I'd like to see if you could work on. Can you reach out to this fellow? Ask, would they sell the name? And if so, what price? And the price came back at $50,000. Oh, well, wow, that's fantastic, because that's half what I was going to try to pay for Vox. But I did not have $50,000. So I did what most of us would do. You go to the friends, family, and fools. Basically, is anyone going to lend me the money to pull this thing off? Everyone was saying no. Let's go to the banks. I go to all the banks. I created the pitch deck. They're like, are you buying servers? Do you need like firewalls? I'm like, no. It's just like, you know, it's just a domain name. And we're going to use like some co-located servers. And they're like, a domain name? Like, can't you just go buy those from GoDaddy for $9.95? I'm like, it doesn't work like that. This one's like a premium name. It's already registered. So everybody said no. Now, this is a really important life lesson, which our lawyer Phil taught me at the time, which is said, never take no for an answer, which is this company was willing, this fellow actually was willing to sell the name. 50,000 was out of the range. What can you do, David? And I'm like, oh, like honestly, 30,000, but I'm going to have to break up the payments. Like, and so we created an offer, which was a counter offer, $30,000, but it was in $5,000 increments. So $5,000 I'll send every quarter for the next 6 quarters. And that's how we'd get there. And with that, he went for the deal. So for $30,000, we were able to acquire the domain name voices.com.
Wow, great story. And no doubt that domain name is worth so much more to you now as a brand, and just the fact that domains appreciate in value. So fantastic.
Going back and looking back, I would say, I just add, that was probably the single best decision, you know, marketing decision, technical decision in a lot of ways that we made in those early years, which was definitely the biggest investment we had made and kind of a commitment in advance. What we ended up doing was pretty much just a lift and shift. Like we had this name, this site running on Interactive Voices. We had this other domain on this new server, which we upgraded the server. We just copied everything over from one server to the other server and then just, you know, redirected the traffic. Think of it like redirecting the mail from one address to the other, right? And not only did our customers like, wow, this is great. We feel like we're, you know, the voice talent, like we feel like we're part of a bigger entity. Like it sounds like we've been there forever. So they were excited for like the brand affinity. And at the time, you know, Google was, I'm going to, dare I say, overweighting the age of the domain name and the keyword in the domain itself, like all of these factors that seem a little rudimentary kind of in hindsight, easily, some easier to manipulate than others, but the age was something you couldn't manipulate. So we ended up tripling our organic traffic from Google, like virtually overnight over that weekend, which just meant that we didn't have to advertise on Google AdWords as much as we had before. So yeah, this is about 2007, as you say, to kind of put a bit of a timestamp on it as well. But yeah, I'm really proud of that moment. And it shows you sometimes you do just need to step out in faith a little bit.
Yeah, I'm even thinking about the email I received about you as a potential guest for this podcast. And the thing that stood out was you had voices.com as your domain name before I even did any research on anything else. It's like, oh, okay, the branding of that, the seriousness of that, the sense you're probably in business for a while. If you came to me and it was called interactivevoices.com in that email, I probably would have thought boutique agency. I don't know how big this is. So it's amazing just the subtle difference of a one word English domain name like that.
We get inquiries inbound from journalists and reporters that are writing about, just like we started off our chat today, AI voices, synthetic voice, people writing about, and I remember one of the first ones was a reporter from CNN shortly after actually we made that change when Kindle, the Amazon first generation, like Amazon Kindle was going to have this like, again, synthetic voice, probably certainly pre Alexa, but this synthetic voice that was going to read out your audiobooks. And the question was, is this going to ruin, you know, the lives of all the audiobook narrators out there? And they were just, it was just an opinion piece, but I was able to weigh in. And why? Do you think, you know, when a journalist is doing research on something, they're going to do what we all do, type in a keyword, and they're going to scan both, you know, is this a brand that's recognizable? Or is it one that looks like it's been there forever? And they're running down the list of names with hyphens and .biz and info and names with, you know, numbers in them. And just, it doesn't, and then you see voices.com is probably in all likelihood the first result. It's just going to be the go-to place. And so that's actually how we even describe our mission of being the definitive destination. That's how we want it to be thought of in the minds of our customers of like, oh, right, this is where you go to hire a great voice for your project.
Yeah, it's definitely helpful. I think for the sake of beginners in the audience, we should say you don't need to have a .com, you know, top level domain name, because there's plenty of examples of, even before we record, we were talking about one of my previous interviews with Envato's co-founder, Collis, and they run marketplaces like you. And their first marketplaces were like ThemeForest and PSD Toots. So they didn't have like themes.com, and they still made a very successful company too. But I think it's definitely an advantage for all the reasons you've said. One other question that I was interested in when you were just telling me the origin story with your wife there, you built the website so she could list herself as voice talent, but you said that was better than running per hour the studio. I wasn't sure though, because would she still not be paid? Is there a payment difference when you're like, is it just studio time per hour? And then if you're hiring a voice talent from a website, the pricing structure is different? Like, I didn't really understand the difference.
Yeah, it was just about scalability, where we viewed, hey, if we could, so the business model at the very beginning was a subscription-based website. Any talent that signed up paid $49 to participate in the marketplace. And again, think about the timeline on this. This was like 2005, almost to the date, actually. October 2005 was when we incorporated and really kind of got the business going. There was no LinkedIn. There was no Facebook, and let alone Friendster. There's no Wix or WordPress, nothing that you're going to go create a profile online. So this was a huge advantage for a freelancer to gain a presence on there, especially when they're an audio-based freelancer. They weren't a designer or graphic designer then enough themselves. So it was a subscription-based model. And the calculus that we had done, which was, hey, either you're doing, you know, Steph, I'm kind of billing out this recording studio, or Stephanie's doing the work at, as I say, $30 an hour, or we can spend our time marketing this platform. And what if we could get a couple hundred people to subscribe, right? And then over time, get more people to subscribe. So long, and our brand promise has always been, in exchange for your annual subscription or membership fee, we will market you. We will bring job opportunities to this marketplace. Then you can audition for and obviously hopefully land. And for the talent, the return on investment is pretty straightforward. Is, hey, if I paid a few hundred dollars in a membership fee, if I make a few thousand dollars back and I win clients that I can continuously work for, that's great. I mean, it's almost like pooling all of their marketing dollars together that we then go out and, you know, aim to dominate the search results, bid up on all the keywords on Google, and really bring those jobs to a central location instead of, which is easier for the client. They're not having to visit 10 websites. They're just going to one and then having the talent respond in a kind of a predictable manner.
Okay. That makes sense. So it's a complete switch in business model, really. It was from,
yes,
we're just going to bill out the service we provide to, we're going to charge the service providers an annual or a subscription fee and deliver, hopefully, work to them. Take us forward from that point then. So you build the website. I realize it wasn't quite yet voices.com, but we've shared that story, which is great. It sounds like, based on the way you described it before, the talent was coming to you. They were just finding you and then asking to be listed. And then, of course, you were starting to charge a subscription fee. And I'm guessing the buyers side of this marketplace were also coming to you, which improved when you got voices.com because of all your rankings went up with the authority, the domain age improving. So then that's organic. Was it a case of one of these stories where you're just struggling to keep up with the demand, or did you still have to go and stimulate demand? Like, what was those first few years like?
Most marketplaces are going to be either supply constrained or demand constrained. And for us, we were demand constrained. There are a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, who believe that doing voiceovers is very easy. It's just simply reading you get paid to talk for a living. It's like, well, you're actually, you're acting. You need to edit. You need to communicate back and forth with the client, maybe even help shape that script. So there's a lot more than just merely reading. And then certainly it's not just reading. It's also interpreting the script and adding something to it, right, to give that great performance. So there's a lot of people who had kind of actors, performers, people who were radio broadcasters, on-air talent, and providing that supply side of the marketplace. Where we were constrained, and admittedly, today it's still the same issue, if you will, which is the business is really driven by, can you bring those clients with the job opportunities to the marketplace? If you can, and give them a great experience, they'll probably keep coming back time and time again. And so at the beginning, I was always the client guy and Stephanie was the talent gal. My job was to call. I mean, I think at one count, we bought Salesforce.com to manage my outbound calling to ad agencies and video production companies. I made 10,000 phone calls in the first couple of years to all of these clients and just trying to basically cold call them, try to get them on the phone, or like send an email as a follow-up and just try to bring people to the website. Because relying exclusively on organic search meant that their current service provider was no longer available. And if there's anything I've learned, and it actually comes from Robert Herjavec, which is nobody switches from good enough to maybe better. You have to be 10x better, right? And I think what was happening in those early days was, yeah, I work with the talent agents. I know a guy who does voiceover, Betty in accounting. She's fantastic. We just use her. Like, there was all of these issues that we had to overcome that in some way or another still persist today. So there's definitely organic and paid search activities, but there's also outbound initiatives that go on to change that buyer's behavior from relying on their kind of current path or current source to considering using voices.com for their next project. So far from being kind of inundated, I think take the perspective that we need to win that client over for every new project. It's a full-on effort to bring those clients and keep them coming back.
So as the story progressed, I could see you both just hustling to build both sides of the marketplace. Correct me if I'm wrong, but did the business model eventually change to no longer charging a subscription fee to the talent, to perhaps the other marketplace model that's quite common, which is take a cut of the transactions? Did eventually that happen?
Yeah, it did. So we still, even to this day, have a subscription element. Talent can sign up for free, or they can upgrade to subscribe to what we call a premium membership, which really, like similar to a LinkedIn membership, kind of unlocks additional features and benefits, statistics, higher ranking in the search results, lets you kind of proactively go after clients and jobs. So there's just, you know, it unlocks new capabilities. But you're right, what we had uncovered was a client would, it didn't happen all that often, but when it did, it was very problematic, which was, hey, we facilitated the connection between client and talent, and we didn't really have a means of enabling the payment to happen. It was just merely the matchmaker. And we viewed that both as an opportunity, certainly to quote unquote monetize the transaction. Talent also were delivering work and then not getting paid for a client that we hooked them up with, and they were holding us responsible. And we'd go, well, did you get 50% up front? Did you ask for a payment? Like, do you know who this person is? Because we just had like a name and an email address. After that having happened enough times, we realized that the role of a marketplace is to be that trusted intermediary, to intervene when needed, but otherwise kind of get out of the middle of that transaction. And so we developed a payment service, which we call SurePay. It's in effect an escrow service, which most marketplaces have something to that effect nowadays, where when the client posts a job and the talent reply, the talent say, I can do this work for $500. The client would actually make that $500 payment by credit card in advance. So we'll be holding on to that full $500 when the work gets done and delivered. So the talent has the peace of mind that they can do the work, guaranteed that they're going to get paid. And the off chance the client says, oh, well, you know, the talent's unavailable, you know, they got ill, whatever reason, we need to hire somebody else. You know, they're not out that money either, so we can help them hire somebody else. In the vast majority of cases, the talent does the work, and then we pay out, talent earn 80% of that. So in kind of a startup community, we would know that as the take rate or the rake. It's a platform fee for work that is successfully kind of completed and consummated on the platform. That's been very effective. I think it aligns our interests. We call it shared success because the higher the amount that the client pays the talent, you know, it's the more that we're making and it's the more that the talent's making as well. So we are, to reuse the term, incentivized to ensure that there are fair and appropriate rates for the kind of work that gets completed on the platform, you know, counter to maybe some that believe, oh no, we're just, you know, purposely trying to drive down the prices. I'm like, why would we want to do that? I mean, it's completely counter to actually our business sustainability. Instead, if we can understand that the client is, this is a national advertising campaign, it's going to be out to a huge audience, it's a big brand, and we can encourage or otherwise inform that client that in order to hire the top talent on the platform, that you need to be raising your budget, then everybody wins. So I think this notion of shared success, you're absolutely right. There's still a small part portion of our business is kind of like the subscription based for the talent. And then the platform transaction fees would be the other part.
What year did you make that switch?
I want to say in like 2011 or so. So it took a while. Like it was a subscription only website for a good long time. And I think we ended up patenting it in the US and Canada, the patents from 2009. Then we had to kind of commercialize it. Like it was a team of a handful of web developers that, you know, you're charting new ground. And it just took us, I think, a while to kind of get it off the ground. And then, of course, the education process of teaching the clients, this is how now you pay a talent on platform. We expect you to do that, as well as informing the talent, hey, we need to, in order for our, you know, sustainability as well, the transactions need to stay on platform. Before, you used to just send PayPal or ask them to pay you some other way. There was a lot of change management, if you will, that needed to occur. But I think we're in a really good spot now. Talent appreciate that they're going to get paid every Friday for work that was done the previous week. So it becomes really like a predictable income stream for them as well, too.
And for you guys, I was actually going to ask, do you remember that switch, how big an impact it meant to the bottom line of your company as well? Because that's quite a dramatic change in business model or pricing model.
Yeah, I mean, it's really like bringing on a whole new revenue stream. And in fact, we actually started initially at 10% and then years later increased it to 20%. And there wasn't single like blip, nobody, no kind of questions asked, sent out the email notification. I think it was like the clients are still getting the same talent. They're happy. The talent are still getting paid for work done. Not that there hasn't been kind of other challenges in terms of, because most things in marketplaces, you know, you have two sets of customers. It's very different than a SaaS business or e-commerce where you have one customer for the most part, two sets of customers with diametrically opposed needs and wants. The sellers want to get top dollar. They're, especially with voice talent, they're artists in a lot of ways too. So they want to take their time. This is their craft. And then the clients want things fast. They want no hassle. They don't want to talk to anyone. They just want to get the delivery of the file and they want to pay as little as possible. So you have to kind of balance and educate both sides of the market all the time, as well as kind of matching that supply and demand for every given job. When we send out a job opportunity, you don't want to send too many responses. It overwhelms the client, you know, the paradox of choice, if you will. If you've ever walked down the jam aisle or the toothpaste aisle, you know what I'm talking about. And if you send too few, then the client thinks, oh, there's not enough variety. There's not enough kind of what we would call marketplace liquidity happening here. So, you know, nailing that, I mean, these are some of the technical challenges that, you know, for the most part, we don't, you know, go into any details. It's just not needed to. We try to keep all the technology as invisible as possible and just create this like frictionless experience so someone can hire the right voice and be on their merry way.
I know from my research that you have raised funding, but it sounds like for a good amount of time, like the funding dates I saw were 2015 and 2017. So we're still talking about years here that you were bootstrapped by the sounds of things. How was that? Like, and in particular, how was that with growing your management team? I understand growing the supply side and the customer side, that was kind of like your initial two roles. But you said just then you built a tech team to roll out this new payment system. You're now sitting in an office where you've obviously had many employees in. What was it like to scale the company? And you're the CEO, so I'm guessing all the hires were certainly your job during the early days. So what was that like?
Oh, yeah. I think I've definitely done over 1,000 interviews. We used to definitely interview, and that's like in person. This isn't just looking at someone's resumes. It began when Stephanie and I divided up our role and responsibilities. We got out an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper and said, I wrote what I think she was strong at and where I think she could excel. And she did the same for me. And I think right away we realized, okay, yeah, Stephanie, you're great with talent. You're going to be the marketing person. You're going to be the literal face and voice of the company in a lot of ways, you know, building up the community, answering a lot of customer support questions. I will be on the client side of the marketplace. I'll handle technology. I'll handle kind of finance and sales. And so that I think is something I would strongly encourage the startup founders and entrepreneurs, if you're working with someone else, just to even have that kind of like tacit agreement, and I'd encourage you to put it on paper. I think that's going to alleviate a lot of kind of questions and concerns. And it's not to do it from a territorial perspective. It's to say, hey, within these healthy boundaries, you have tons of free rein, and here's the ultimate decision maker within that space. And I think we've applied that when it came to hiring employee number one. It was, we tend to hire kind of, I don't know how prudent this is, but kind of more reactionary of like, oh my goodness, we are getting so many customer support questions. We need somebody to kind of backstop a lot of these. And then it became finance. It was just a highly transactional business. This is not my suit. It's not what I'm trained in or have a passion for. So let's hire someone who can also now handle customer support cases and, you know, close the books on a monthly basis from a finance point of view. But I think what we ended up putting in a really lightweight recruiting system, and I just kind of had this notion that like, yeah, we're probably going to, if things continue to go well, and we can talk about kind of the financing of that as well too. But in terms of hiring, I mean, I was always on this continuous intake approach. There was always job opportunities listed on our site for employees. And we just collected resumes and it kind of became one of those like daily activities. What I always looked for, what I call the three C's, I guess, nowadays, which is somebody who's curious. It almost doesn't matter what role you're in. Certainly a designer, a developer, or somebody in sales. But if you're curious, that's great. You want to understand the reason why. You're probably going to challenge the process that we have to go, does it need to be this way? Or has it just been like that for years? So I love curiosity. I also love competitiveness, whether you're competitive with yourself, you know, I want to do better than yesterday. I want to do better than my peers in a healthy competition way. I want to beat that quota that you've assigned me or reach the goal or complete the sprint faster than we said we were going to do or minimally on time. That's often an achievement in and of itself. And then the last one I would say is coachable, where there are going to be times where we miss the mark or we come up short. And somebody who can receive feedback, and I know a lot of people say, oh, they want the feedback, but do you receive it well and apply it? And so that's what we looked for in terms of some intangible traits, if you will, that don't always show up on a resume, but we certainly looked for a lot of that. And then likewise trained our initial leaders. You know, one of our first leaders was a VP of finance, you know, VP of sales. These are kind of like the building out kind of a four VP of technology. There's like a 4 or 5 person leadership team in the earliest days. And then nowadays it's a little bit bigger than that, but you know, those are the kind of the critical roles, product finance, sales, marketing, and technology.
And how many people, I just saw one walk right behind you there. So how many people work with you today?
We're at 130 people here, and everyone's in the vicinity, I would say, of London, Ontario, which, you know, is kind of an hour and a half-ish out of Toronto. But I mean, people have decided to move back to Toronto. I think we're highly flexible on that. You know, we've just realized, hey, we just now need to cover mileage for people if we're going to call them into the office. But I think we've, for years, I was like insistent that we all needed to be together. But our business has thrived over the last 18 to 24 months here, part and parcel because I think the pandemic was the greatest awareness event that we never asked for. People could no longer go into recording studios or work with a talent agent face to face and kind of do things the old way. And they ended up going to Google and saying, I still have an ad campaign. I need to update my phone system. The number of restaurants that would call us to say they're no longer taking reservations, like they just need a new voice on their phone system, like really basic things, or like public service announcements, corporate training videos where just a